copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Now we're going to turn our attention to another kind of ideology that was going to contribute to the devaluing of human life. And while on the one hand there were biological determinists and environmental determinists who were buying into materialistic philosophies, and I've shown how they have devalued human life in their own ways, there also was another strand of philosophical thinking that arose in the 19th and 20th centuries that was going to be pretty have a big impact on devaluing human life. And this is a form of philosophy known as existentialism and postmodernism. And in many ways, they were reacting against scientific materialism. So they're going to be very unlike the scientific materialists in that they're very anti-science in their kind of orientation. And they're not going to be deterministic. So whereas you have biological determinism and environmental determinism share their belief in determinism, Nietzsche, Foucault, and some of these other existentialists and postmodernist thinkers are going to recognize that humans have freedom, and so they're going to emphasize the radical freedom of humanity. And one of the most prominent philosophers of the late 20th century, Michel Foucault, was a follower of Nietzsche, and he embraced the death of God. He thought that was a good part of Nietzsche's philosophy. And he explicitly claimed that the death of God leads to the death of humanity. That was actually explicitly in his philosophy. And because of that, he even promoted suicide, and he was very fascinated with suicide. He mentions it in a number of cases. He actually, as a young man, rather, he actually attempted suicide a couple of times, more than once. And he said that if he won the lottery, he would set up a suicide clinic where other people could come and commit suicide. And he talks about there's fascination with suicide and other elements of a philosophy too. So there's this fascination with death that comes out in Foucault's philosophy. But the roots of that go way back to Nietzsche, in fact. And Foucault was building upon Nietzsche's philosophy and read Nietzsche pretty extensively. Now, Nietzsche, interestingly, who is the father of existentialist philosophy, claimed that he was promoting a life-affirming philosophy. So how is it that I can claim that he was leading to the death of humanity and promoting death when he's claiming that he's promoting life? He's promoting, he's life-affirming and such. Well, there's several things about his philosophy that make it very problematic from my perspective in thinking about, the value of human life and such. First of all, Nietzsche denied human equality. He didn't believe that humans were equal. He had utter contempt for the masses of humanity. He had utter contempt for all women. He was completely misogynist. He was continually opposing Christian morality because it focused on helping the weak and the poor, and it taught compassion on people. And Nietzsche thought those were bad things. He thought we shouldn't be focusing on the weak and the sick. Instead, he was creating a philosophy that he thought should promote the creative individual. He called them the Übermensch, the overman or superman, variously translated there. So, and this Übermensch was supposed to be this creative individual who dominates and even enslaves others. And he actually uses that term, enslave, or he even uses the term at one point to, even if necessary, to exterminate the masses around, but certainly to dominate and to oppress. And again, those are terms he actually uses, that these creative individuals should be dominating and oppressing other people around them. Let me one quotation from Nietzsche, and again, you need to be careful with Nietzsche quotations too, because he has all these aphorisms and such. You can take Nietzsche in a lot of different directions, and Nietzscheans have gone in a lot of different directions. But in any case, we'll give us some flavor of it, I think. Here's one thing that he said. He said, quote, "The essential characteristic of a good and healthy aristocracy, however," and here he's not talking, by the way, about the traditional aristocracy coming out of Europe. He's not talking about the barons and the dukes. He's talking about this creative aristocracy, these creative individuals that are going to be part of the Übermensch. So he says, "The essential characteristic of a good and healthy aristocracy, however, is that it accepts with a good conscience the sacrifice of untold human beings who, for its sake, must be reduced and lowered to incomplete human beings, to slaves, to instruments." So the people on the top of society, he thought, are supposed to enslave other people and just make them the instruments of their own desires and pleasures, or their own will. And of course, the word "will to power" here, one of his famous works that was put out. They're exerting their will, and they're trying to use in power to dominate other people. And he thought that's what humanity was all about. Humanity is about trying to dominate and use your will to control other people and to dominate them. And that was pretty much what his whole philosophy was about. At another point, he said, quote, "To sacrifice humanity as a mass to the welfare of a single stronger human species would indeed constitute progress." Okay, to sacrifice humanity as mass, so to get rid of most humans for these superior ones, he says would be an act of progress. He rejected any kind of universal morality, so that's where you get sort of the beyond good and evil. In other words, he thinks there's no such thing as fixed, objective moral standards. He thought that these creative individuals should create their own morality. Now, he didn't think that everyone is going to create their own morality. He thought that the creative individuals, the aristocratic elites, and again, he's not talking about the traditional aristocrats here, he's talking about these creative individuals. He thought that they should create morality and then impose it on everyone else. So he saw morality as the thing that is created by the top layers of society, the elites, and then gets imposed on everyone else, who then has to submit to whatever those moral standards are. And so he specifically criticized Christian love and compassion, which he called herd morality, the morality for the masses and such. And he specifically even denied that humans have a right to life. And here we're dealing with the issue of devaluing human life. So Nietzsche denied that humans have a right to life. He said, quote, "The great majority of men have no right to existence." The great majority of men have no right to existence. Okay, so it completely obliterates the idea of the right to life. He approved of suicide very clearly in some of his passages in his writings, and also infanticide and killing people with disabilities. He specifically promotes the idea that people with disabilities should be killed. He sees them as they're the weak, they're the, you know, they're the sick, and we need to get rid of them to promote human progress of these Übermensch people. So with this kind of a philosophy, it probably is not surprising that a lot of young people who became very enthusiastic with Nietzsche's philosophy, which by the 1890s was becoming pretty influential, especially again among young people who were trying to rebel against the status quo and who saw him as a sort of a hero of this rebellion, the youthful rebellion. A lot of young people who began to like Nietzsche began exalting and extolling violence. And there are quite a number of people, and a lot of people took Nietzsche in different directions by the 1890s and early 1900s. I mean, very interestingly, even the feminist movement began idolizing Nietzsche, despite the fact that Nietzsche was contemptuous of women, because they liked the way that he bashed the status quo, the traditional morality, and such. They were sharing the same enemy, so to speak, and so they latched onto the elements of Nietzsche that they liked there. But there also were a lot of other ways in which Nietzsche was going to feed into violence in various ways. During World War I, it was said that many German young men going out to battle carried Thus Spake Zarathustra around with them in their knapsacks. And so Nietzsche's works were very prominently read by many of the young people. But interestingly, it seems that the World War I itself may have arisen in partly out of a Nietzschean context. Gavrilo Princip, who was the assassin of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand in 1914, the event that touched off World War I, he was an avid Nietzschean. Now, of course, that wasn't the only thing motivating him. He was a Serb nationalist, and his Serb nationalism was stirring up his hatred toward the Austrian Empire, Austro-Hungarian Empire, and was motivating him. But he was a very avid Nietzschean, as was Mussolini. Benito Mussolini in Italy admired Nietzsche and read Nietzsche very prolifically in his early days. And he was also going to be a strong advocate of violence and domination, and tried to exercise him, sort of become this Nietzschean Übermensch, so to speak. Hitler, even though Hitler was not as quite as influenced by Nietzsche as maybe Mussolini was, Hitler did want to be connected to Nietzsche in certain ways. He does quote Nietzsche in various times, and he certainly saw himself as this creative individual who then would dominate society and such. Here's a shot showing you Hitler when he visited the Nietzsche archive in 1934. This is a shot taken by his personal photographer, Heinrich Hoffmann. This is a statue of Nietzsche there, and Hitler standing across from it there. And this was then published in a book of Heinrich Hoffmann, trying to basically show the connections of Hitler with Nietzsche. And not only did he visit the archive, by the way, he actually contributed some of his own personal funds toward the archive at various times and promoted the work of the Nietzsche archive, which was promoting, obviously, the work of Friedrich Nietzsche. So there's ways in which Hitler was supporting Nietzschean philosophy. Hitler was actually a little bit more influenced by Schopenhauer, who also influenced Nietzsche to some degree as well. But anyway, I think it sort of shows the connections they have between their opposition to Christian compassion, helping the weak, helping the sick, rather Nietzsche was teaching get rid of the weak, get rid of the sick, and destroy the and dominate other people. And so I think this is illustrates the point we're trying to make here. Now, interestingly, existentialist philosophers that followed after Nietzsche also contributed to the devaluing of human life. Martin Heidegger, who is one of the most famous philosophers of the 20th century, rejected any fixed moral truths or any human rights. Interestingly, he was going to sort of demote the individual and exalt the people or state. And in fame, December 1933, in an address that he gave, he said, quote, "The individual, wherever he may stand, is worth nothing." Okay, the individual, wherever he may stand, is worth nothing. "The destiny of our people in its state is worth everything." So that was Heidegger's perspective. So it demotes the value of the human individual. You know, it's just the nation and the state that's important. The individual doesn't really matter a whole lot. And in fact, Heidegger was going to endorse Hitler in the first couple of years of the Nazi regime. Heidegger was appointed as rector of the University of Freiburg and was going to implement Nazi policies there. By the mid to late 1930s, he actually was really sort of pulled back some from his avid support of Nazism, but he never repented of it. And even after World War II, he basically tried to cover up his support for the Nazi period. But in the 1990s, a lot of scholarship came out that started showing how tightly Heidegger was connected with the Nazi movement, especially in 1933 and 34. In any case, existentialism didn't necessarily lead to Hitler and Nazism, because Jean-Paul Sartre, one of the more famous existentialist philosophers who studied under Heidegger, and who argued that his philosophy showed that life was absurd and had no meaning. That was sort of the central core tenet of sort of Sartre's way of thinking, is that life is absurd and it has no meaning. Sartre claimed that that was simply the consequence of his atheistic worldview, that life is absurd. And he also admitted at one point in one of his essays, he wrote an essay called Existentialism is a Humanism, which is a good summation of his philosophy. He admitted in that essay that everything is indeed permitted if God does not exist. That, by the way, goes back to a saying of Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky had made that stating about it, that everything is permitted if God does not exist. And Jean-Paul Sartre agreed with Dostoevsky and said, yes, everything is permitted if God does not exist. However, when you look at the political way that he was going to take this, he was going to take it in a completely different direction than Heidegger, because Jean-Paul Sartre was a communist. He was promoting Marxism, kind of an unorthodox brand of Marxism, because existentialism isn't completely compatible with Marxism's ideas about economic determinism and everything. But a lot of French intellectuals in the late 1940s and early 1950s were Marxists. In fact, it was the vast majority of French intellectuals were Marxists at the time in that period. And Jean-Paul Sartre was one of those. In fact, he was even made lots of justifications for Stalin. He spoke very highly of Stalin and Stalinist regime in the 1940s and 50s. In the 1960s and 70s, after it was obvious that Stalin was even discredited by Khrushchev in his de-Stalinization campaign that came out in 1956, which took the wind out of the sails of a lot of the French intellectuals, because now even the Soviets weren't upholding Stalin anymore. But in the 1960s and 70s, Sartre expressed approval for the Red Army faction, which was a terrorist organization in Germany that was blowing up buildings, committing acts of arson, bank robberies, and such. And Jean-Paul Sartre expressed approval of the Red Army faction's murders in the 1960s and 70s. And so these are just some of the ways that he was sort of devaluing a human life in seeing that they're justifying the murders by the Red Army faction. Foucault was going to sort of follow in the train of the existentialists in certain ways, and that Foucault was very interested in Nietzsche's philosophy. However, he was going to take it in directions that marked something of a break with existentialism, and I don't want to go into a whole long discourse on this, but Foucault's philosophy reference referred to postmodern philosophy. Foucault is a very interesting individual, especially when you start looking at his individual personal life, because he was also very interested in the Marquis de Sade's philosophical works and novels and things like that. The Marquis de Sade is the person that we get the word sadism from. And Marquis de Sade was a figure in the late 18th century who preached that life is all about pleasure, and whatever brings you pleasure, even if it means harming other people, even if it means bringing pain, that's where the word sadism is going to come from. Even if your pleasure is in giving other people pain, then you're justified in doing that. And Foucault was very fascinated with the Marquis de Sade's philosophy. And Foucault himself was going to be a practitioner of sadomasochistic sex. He was a homosexual, and he was practicing sadomasochism in his sexual life. Foucault also promoted mind-altering drugs. He was very much into drug use of quite a number of sorts. He said one of the greatest events of his entire life was an LSD trip that he had when he first tried LSD back in, I think it was in the 60s. In any case, he promoted the use of mind-altering drugs. He thought he was looking for these what he called intense pleasures, and he thought he got them through the use of drugs, and that would then be sort of his focal goal of his life's pursuit. He promoted suicide. We already mentioned that part right toward the top. He also espoused radical leftist revolutionary political views. At times he referred to himself as a Marxist, but he certainly wasn't an orthodox Marxist, just like Sartre wasn't. He basically was just opposed to any kind of authority. He was basically a rebel against any kind of authority, any part of the status quo he was opposed to. And so in the 1970s, for example, that meant that he came out against the Shah of Iran, who was considered and was one of the more oppressive governments in the world at the time. And so Khomeini actually Foucault supported Khomeini the leader of the Iranian Revolution in the late 1970s. And Foucault even met with Khomeini and was a very big supporter of Khomeini before Khomeini came to power. Not recognizing, of course, Khomeini was going to bring in a more oppressive regime than what he replaced, which, by the way, happens quite frequently historically. It's pretty remarkable how historically you look at these movements that start out promoting revolution and promising freedom from oppression and such. And very often, once those revolutions happen, you end up with more oppression than you started with. Obviously, there are exceptions to that, but in many cases, that's exactly what happens. Foucault, in his philosophy, tried to dismantle objective morality and believe that there's no such thing as objective moral truths. In fact, he didn't really believe there were objective truths at all. He thought that all knowledge is subjective and created by us as humans. And so everything that we believe is just a social construct. You know, there's nothing objectively true out there. It's all, you know, in our minds and such. And so his philosophy was about trying to convince people of his position, even though he realized that his, quote, position didn't have any objectivity to it. So rhetoric becomes very important, by the way, and for postmodernists in general, not just Foucault, but for postmodernists in general, rhetoric becomes very important because what your discourse is about is trying to convince people of your position and trying to impose your views on other people, even though you know that your views don't have any objective reality to them. So interestingly, the way this worked out in morality, in 1971, Foucault did a debate with Noam Chomsky. And Noam Chomsky is no conservative. Noam Chomsky is a revolutionary himself. Noam Chomsky considers himself a Marxist revolutionary. Noam Chomsky, if you don't know, was a famous linguist in the late 20th century. One of the most famous linguists, in fact, of the late 20th century. And Chomsky did this debate with Foucault on human nature. And so it's been published here, which is where I've read. That's a shot showing you Foucault himself. But Chomsky stated after the debate took place, he said, "I felt like I was talking to someone who didn't inhabit the same moral universe." And the reason for that was because Chomsky was claiming that the reason you needed to have a Marxist revolution was to restore justice, to bring about a just social order. And Foucault objected to that. And Foucault said, no, there is no such thing as justice. Justice is non-existent. You're not fighting for justice. And in that debate, he rejected any appeal to morality or human rights. And this is very interesting, too, because at times, Foucault would use the language of human rights to try to convince people of his particular position. And he'd talk about oppression, people not, you know, people violating human rights and different things like that. But he didn't really believe there was such a thing as human rights. Certainly not any objective human rights. And so in that debate, here is what he said, and this is very interesting. He said, "When the proletariat takes power, it may be quite possible that the proletariat will exert towards the classes over which it has just triumphed a violent, dictatorial, and even bloody power. I can't see what objection one could make to this," he said. I can think of a lot of objections to violent dictatorial power. But for Foucault, that's just fine. Violent dictatorial power, as long as it's overthrowing the status quo, as long as it's overthrowing the powers that be, are now, again, it's Foucault's whole philosophy is just a philosophy of rebellion against authority, and whatever it takes to destroy authority is fine, even if it brings about violent dictatorial bloody power, he says here. So that's sort of where his philosophy ends up then, and again, why I would argue that it does devalue human life. And Foucault's not alone. There's a lot of other postmodernist philosophers who have bought into similar kinds of ideas. Just to give one kind of example, Jean Baudrillard, a French postmodernist thinker, of course Foucault's French as well, when the 9/11 attacks took place in 2001 on the Trade Towers in the United States, the postmodernist Jean Baudrillard exulted in the death and destruction that took place on 9/11. And he wrote a book about it that came out in 2002, so the year after the 9/11 attack. And here's what he said. He said, terrorism is immoral. Well, we could agree with him there. But then he went on to say, the World Trade Center event, that symbolic challenge, is immoral. And it is a response to globalization, which is itself immoral. So he's claiming that they were attacking this globalization, and that globalization is immoral too. But then he goes on to say, and immediately after he says, so let us be immoral. And if we want to have some understanding of all this, let us go and take a little look beyond good and evil. Okay, so there's harking back to Nietzsche's terminology, his Nietzsche's book, Beyond Good and Evil. So the notion is that, okay, the 9/11 Trade Center destruction, you know, through the planes wrecking into it, that was immoral. But what the people were doing in the trade centers was immoral too. In fact, he actually specifically states that what was going on in the trade centers was immorality, and so they were just sort of taking revenge on this immorality going on there. And Baudrillard shows absolutely no sympathy for the people in the trade centers. He basically sees them as getting what they deserved in that episode. And so he says, the way we make sense of that, he said, then, is let us go and look a little beyond good and evil. So, again, showing the Nietzschean influence there on postmodernism. So, as I think I've already suggested, this notion of getting beyond good and evil, a notion where there is no real fixed morality, there's no objective morality out there, as Nietzsche and many of his followers have suggested, it does lead us to the death of humanity. And again, Foucault himself admitted that overtly. It rids the world of notions like human rights, which Nietzsche and his followers and Foucault and others overtly denied. They denied there was any such thing as human rights. It denies even the right to life. And so any respect for human life is gone as well. So I believe that we as Christians then need to try to confront these dehumanizing ideologies by showing the value of human life and the value of all human life. We need to emphasize human equality. We need to emphasize human rights and human morality. And especially, we need to emphasize Christian love, which I think is the antidote to all of this, and which Nietzsche was very forthrightly attacking. Nietzsche was attacking love and compassion, the very thing that we need to bring forward to show people the reality of, that I think can have an impact on people's lives and make them realize that human life does really have value.